WBUR Boston. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Al-Qaeda. Since 9/11, the group has haunted our national consciousness. Counterterrorism has become the bread and butter of national security. With the death of Osama bin Laden, some expected Al-Qaeda to be a fading threat. But in Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Nigeria, and now Mali, and even Syria, Al-Qaeda is growing. This hour On Point, the new Al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation. Do you feel Al-Qaeda is a real and present danger to America? If so, how should we attack? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll hear from Al-Qaeda expert Seth Jones of the RAND Corporation and Daniel Byman of the Brookings Institution. But first, let's go overseas. Joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey, is Gaith Abdul Ahad, correspondent for The Guardian. He's been on the ground in Syria these past few weeks. Gaith, great to have you.
Hi, Wayne.
Gaith, we're talking about Syria. How big a presence is Al-Qaeda in Syria, and how much a problem for the rebels, the Free Syrian Army?
Well, Wayne, if I can start by, like you, I thought after the killing of Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda was dead. But a couple of months ago, I was in Yemen interviewing Al-Qaeda. Now I was in Syria interviewing Al-Qaeda. They seem to have a new breath of life. They're kind of emerging as a small cell. I would like to call it Al-Qaeda 2.1. It's a different from Al-Qaeda that was in Afghanistan, focusing on attacking the United States. It's a new Al-Qaeda, a very local Al-Qaeda, and constitute a more present danger to the people of Syria, of Yemen, than I think the United States. For example, in Syria, they have reconstituted the cells from Iraq. They have emerged in the eastern part of Syria and the northern part of Syria, and they are in the hundreds, which is a huge number for Al-Qaeda operatives.
What sort of effect are they having in the fighting?
Well, they are bringing their expertise, the things they've learned from Iraq. So they're very well, in setting car bombs, IEDs, landmines, all the things they've used against the Americans in Iraq. They're bringing these expertise into Syria, and it's a useful thing for the Free Syrian Army. So you have this kind of marriage of convenience at this moment between the Free Syrian Army and Al-Qaeda. Though the Free Syrian Army hates Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda kind of denounces the Free Syrian Army, but there is a marriage of convenience.
And why does the Free Syrian Army hate Al-Qaeda?
Well, the Free Syrian Army, even the Islamist side of the Free Syrian Army, they're very moderate Islamists, seculars, moderate Islamists. They don't share anything with Al-Qaeda in terms of ideology or goals or aims or anything. Yet, the Free Syrian Army is fighting this, regime. They're fighting it with AK-47s, Kalashnikovs, and RPGs. And when Al-Qaeda comes with support, with help, in the absence of everyone else, of course they will take the help from whatever side it comes.
Is there any threat of them co-opting the Free Syrian Revolution?
Look, even the activists themselves, the people, the Free Syrian Army or the activists, will tell you, like, we're seeing the revolution being stolen away, not only by Al-Qaeda, but by other kind of, extremist parts. That's a huge, big problem for the activists. The people who kind of started the revolution against an oppressive regime, they see the revolution is taken by another kind of oppressive power. But yet, Al-Qaeda has expertise in fighting, and they need these expertise.
The Obama administration has decided it's in the United States' best interest to end Bashar Assad's rule. Do we need to open up a second front in Syria, conduct a covert campaign against Al-Qaeda?
Well, I don't know. That's kind of goes back to you. I mean, the way I see Al-Qaeda threat, and not only in Syria, a couple of months ago I was in Yemen. I was interviewing Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And in Yemen, it's a much bigger threat than in Syria. The way I see the threat, I see the threat on the local population. You see Al-Qaeda, unlike the days of Afghanistan, when Al-Qaeda only existed in the mountains, rarely they went down to the streets, met the people. You see Al-Qaeda now This is why I call it Al-Qaeda 2.0. Al-Qaeda is emerging as a force in the street. So you see them in Syria and Yemen and other places openly kind of interacting with the people, openly recruiting people to their cause. And this hasn't happened for a decade.
Gaith Abdul-Ahad is a correspondent for The Guardian. He's speaking with us from Istanbul. Gaith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go to another corner of the world.
There's let open one man's stomach. There's no life for women, and everything is forbidden.
That was 18-year-old Fatuma, a refugee in Mali, speaking to CNN last week. Islamic militants have taken over the northern part of Mali, driving many out of their villages. Joining us now from Bamako, Mali, is Ofabia Quist-Arkton, African correspondent for NPR. Hello.
Greetings, Wade.
Good. Can you hear me?
Yep. A bit of a poor line, but as long as you can hear me.
Can you brief us a little bit about what is going on in Mali with Al-Qaeda there?
How long have you got? It seems from what your previous speaker was saying, the Guardian correspondent, that Al-Qaeda is morphing itself into all sorts of different groups depending on where they are operating in the world. Here in the deserts of northern Mali, we've got Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Their initials are AQIM in English, and Ansardine, and another one called Mujao. Mujao means something about jihad and union in West Africa. Ansardine is defenders of the faith. Now, these groups were not the ones that launched the rebellion in northern Mali. That was by Tuareg separatists. And what the nomadic Tuareg separatists wanted was independence for their northern homeland. But the rebellion has been hijacked with these Al-Qaeda-linked groups who are enforcing very strict Islamic law in the region. You heard that young lady just now in the CNN clip. Many people are saying that the form of Islam that they're bringing to northern Mali is going to radically change the face of this country. Many Malians believe and practice Sufism, an intellectual, very tolerant form of Islam. So many, although this is a Muslim-majority country, you have many Malians who are deeply worried. Just over the weekend, the Islamists apparently meted out the most brutal punishment to a couple who were accused of either adultery or of being unwed and having children. Whatever the case, they were buried up to their necks and then stoned to death in front of a crowd of 200 people. This has really shocked Malians, really shocked them. And apart from that, you have women who are being punished because they're deemed to be improperly dressed, children not allowed to watch television or play soccer, people not allowed to smoke or play cards, everything that Malians have been used to, because Islam has been implanted in this country for centuries. Suddenly, it's all changing. So that's why Mali is really worried, and of course the U.S. as well, because they say that the north of Mali is becoming a terrorist haven.
We're speaking with Ofabia Quist-Arkton, the African correspondent for NPR. You, the Islamist militants have taken over the north. You've been there. You've been describing what you've seen. Does there seem to be any sort of pushback from government or anywhere else?
Well, this is it. Everybody seems totally powerless because it happened so quickly. And I just have to say, Wade, that it's not just the problem in the north. Here in the south, in the capital, Bamako, there was a coup d'etat in March, and that has left the country also totally plummeted, not knowing what to do. Mali had the reputation of being a really stable, robustly stable model African democracy for 20 years. Many people said that this was simply, an illusion. That's what the West, even Africa, wanted. They wanted a star pupil. Mali was it. But in the North, there has been drug trafficking, people trafficking, kidnapping. Of course, the Al-Qaeda-linked groups, kidnapping especially Westerners, and receiving huge ransoms, which has, of course, made them wealthy and able to be armed to the teeth with sophisticated weapons. The Tuareg nomads who were hoping for independence in the north, many of them came over from Libya, where they had been fighting for Muammar Gaddafi, and it seemed that they were also armed to the teeth with sophisticated weapons. But they didn't have the continuing stream of money that apparently these al-Qaeda-linked groups have. And it's not just here in Mali. They're linked to Boko Haram, which means Western education is sinful, based in Nigeria. But you have lots of people in Timbuktu, that historic city where Sufi saints' tombs have been desecrated. They have literally been brought down and destroyed with pickaxes by these Islamists, and Malians are in shock. They can't believe that their lives have changed overnight, but these fighters are very clearly in control of the north.
Fabia Quist-Arkton is the African correspondent for NPR. She spoke with us from Bamako, Mali. Fabia, thank you so much for that report.
Always a pleasure. And Mujawo is the movement for unity and jihad in West Africa.
This is On Point. I am Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. Last week in Reno, Nevada, President Obama spoke to the 113th National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. He was optimistic about the nation's counterterrorism efforts.
Since I took office, we've worked with our allies and our partners to take out more top al-Qaeda leaders than any time since 9/11. And thanks to the courage and the skill of our forces, Osama bin Laden will never threaten America again, and al-Qaeda is on the road to defeat.
We're talking about the threat of al-Qaeda. Is it really, as the president said, on the road to defeat? Joining us from Washington is Seth Jones, senior political scientist and associate director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's the author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of al-Qaeda After 9/11, and How Terrorist Groups End, Lessons for Countering al-Qaeda. Seth, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Wade. It's good to be on.
Seth, al-Qaeda was centered in Afghanistan until we invaded and pushed them into Pakistan, and it was a bin Laden-led effort.
It was a bin Laden effort at that point, and it was much more of a centralized, hierarchical group. But as we've seen over the past decade, we have a different al-Qaeda. One of your previous speakers, Gaith from Syria, noted an al-Qaeda 2.1. I mean, what it looks like right now, and it's important to identify what al-Qaeda is and what it isn't right now, is it still has a central command node in Pakistan. It's now led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two for Osama bin Laden. And then in addition, it has four main affiliates, one in Yemen, one in Iraq, one in North Africa, and one in Somalia. The leaders or emirs of all of those groups have sworn loyalty to Zawahiri. So they have a connection. They speak somewhat regularly. There's guidance that comes from Pakistan. And then what we've seen in a few places like Syria is al-Qaeda in Iraq's branch has moved into Syria and pushed fighters. So there is a connection between a range of these groups we're talking about. Outside of that, Wade, what we have is a much larger, fragmented range of militant groups, many of which are not associated, some of which may be, but it becomes a lot more fractious as you move out from those four main affiliates.
And the drone strikes in Pakistan that were driving the Pakistanis crazy, they were aimed at crippling which al-Qaeda faction?
They were aimed at crippling the al-Qaeda node in Pakistan. That's the central node. They have killed a range of senior leaders. Most of those leaders, actually all of them, have been replaced in some capacity, heads of external operation, the religious committee, media committees, and obviously the head, bin Laden himself, have all been replaced. It appears to be a weaker group right now. They do appear to be involved in less plotting against the U.S. homeland. But as we've seen in the past, al-Qaeda is not linear. Its strength ebbs and flows over what I call a series of waves and counterwaves. So just because it's in trouble right now does not necessarily mean it'll be like that forever.
Let me bring in from Washington Daniel Byman, professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown's University School of Foreign Service. He's also the director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. His paper, Breaking the Bonds Between Al-Qaeda and Its Affiliate Organizations, is just out. You can find a link to the analysis at our website, onpointradio.org. Dan, it's great to have you on the show again.
Thanks for having me, Wade.
If bin Laden's al-Qaeda was focusing on punishing the United States for its military presence in Saudi Arabia, what are the goals of al-Qaeda now and these other affiliates?
The al-Qaeda core still has a goal of attacking the United States and, quite broadly, pushing it out of the Muslim world. With the affiliate organizations, there's a lot of variation. Most of them are primarily focused on their country and, to a considerable degree, their region. But within these, within this theater, they're taking on anti-Western, anti-U.S. targets, so attacking the U.N. in Algeria, say, or attacking Americans and Westerners in the Arabian Peninsula. But we've seen, most dangerously, al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula in particular trying to reach out and attack U.S. aviation targets. And this has many people concerned that the affiliates are becoming more global and that this is a real change in al-Qaeda's power.
Al-Qaeda is generally Sunni in makeup?
Al-Qaeda is entirely Sunni in makeup. This is an organization that favors one particular strand of Sunnism, which is a Salafi strand. And even within that broader rather narrow interpretation, it's quite narrow as well. So this is a minority within a minority of the overall Muslim community.
Well, we've seen that al-Qaeda has not, and we just heard reports that al-Qaeda is not usually reluctant to attack other Muslims. Why hasn't this undermined their efforts?
Al-Qaeda's attacks on other Muslims have undermined their efforts. We saw this in particular in Iraq, where really their wholesale slaughter of other Muslims discredited the overall brand. It's something that we know from documents that were captured during the bin Laden raid that even bin Laden himself was quite upset about the damage these deaths had done to al-Qaeda. Ayman Zawahiri, the current leader, had to answer broad criticism from people around the Muslim world saying, you claim you're defending Muslims, yet you're killing them. So this has been something that's hurt them. But there is a strand within Islam that they appeal to that is very sectarian, that is very intolerant. And so on the one hand, they're on the defensive about the killing of innocent Muslims. On the other hand, it's something that groups that associate themselves with al-Qaeda do on a regular basis.
Seth, what is it that al-Qaeda brings that seems appealing to other groups in other places that allows them to kind of bubble up?
Well, I think one thing that they have been able to bring to certain locations is money, which they continue to receive from various donors in the Persian Gulf and in the Syrian case in the Levant. They bring fighters, many of them who have been trained in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the training camps in the tribal areas of Pakistan. But they also do bring a very anti-Western, anti-American ideology that does resonate in some areas. As we've seen with some of the Pew Charitable Trust polling data, though, their popular support in a range of locations has gone down. So what they do in areas where they don't have large amounts of popular support is use intimidation, targeted killings to try to expand their support base.
Should we be encouraged by the results from the Pew Charitable Trust surveys?
Well, I would say we should be careful. We don't have good data on key countries like Somalia and Yemen. In several others like Nigeria, there appears to be fairly substantial amounts of support for al-Qaeda and its ideology. At the moment, that has transferred to support for Boko Haram, a Salafist group that operates predominantly in northern parts of the country. So some aspects of it, sure, we should certainly be happy that al-Qaeda has lost support in some areas, But I think our data is not as good as it could be across the board.
Gentlemen, let me play a little tape. On Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Daniel Benjamin spoke at the release of the 2011 Counterterrorism Report at the U.S. State Department.
The report's narrative notes, among other things, the continued weakening of the al-Qaeda core in Pakistan, but it also demonstrates that the al-Qaeda affiliates, while also suffering losses, increased their overall operational ability. And this is particularly true of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So for all the counterterrorism successes that we've seen against al-Qaeda and its affiliates, the group and violent extremist ideology and rhetoric continue to spread in some parts of the world.
In 2008, Canadian diplomat and former UN peace envoy Robert Fowler was captured in Niger near the border with Mali and held captive for months by al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition today and shared what he learned from his time with the men.
You cannot discuss peace with the al-Qaeda gang. They are simply not interested in any such discussion. The only thing they're interested in is ending the government of men and substituting it for the government of God.
Dan, there's no talking to al-Qaeda?
The hardcore al-Qaeda types are committed to violent struggle and nothing is going to change that. So for those people, you kill them, you arrest them, you otherwise try to take them out of the game. The people you can talk to, though, are those who haven't yet joined but find aspects of the ideology attractive, and more broadly, people who sympathize and support, perhaps give money. Those people you're not going to win over to a pro-American, pro-Western point of view, but they can be turned against al-Qaeda. Many of them have been turned off by the killings of Muslims, by the very extreme interpretations of the faith. So there is a possibility for dialogue, but not with al-Qaeda itself or its immediate affiliates.
Let me ask you both, Dad and then Seth. Politically unstable areas seem to act as mulch for al-Qaeda, where governments are in transition or beginning to fail. What is the relationship here?
The relationship is fairly direct. Al-Qaeda is in trouble if there is a government that is strong and determined to act against it. So we saw al-Qaeda flare up in Saudi Arabia in 2003, and the Saudi government crushed it and crushed it quite effectively. However, in neighboring Yemen, where the government was much weaker, al-Qaeda was able to rebound. So if you look at where al-Qaeda affiliates are strong today, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, the Maghreb area, these are areas where there is government weakness and continued instability. And if you look at where there are danger zones, so Nigeria, Mali, the Sinai Peninsula, these are also areas where governments are weak. So al-Qaeda goes into these areas and uses them as a base and is able to exploit them in part because there's no one strong there who can stop them.
Seth, it's not that there's an unlimited number of weak governments, but there are many. What's a superpower to do?
Well, I think Dan's point about Saudi Arabia is a good one. The U.S. And the British supported Saudi efforts to crush al-Qaeda elements in Saudi Arabia between about 2003 and 2008. And the efforts there are illustrative. It was not just the work of intelligence, police, and military operatives, all of which is important. But there were elements of that strategy, I think, that are worth looking at very carefully. And they included a very, very effective, what you might call, information operations campaign. Some of the more conservative Sunni clerics who were viewed very legitimately among the Saudi population denounced al-Qaeda. Combated their ideas on the internet, on social media, on TV, in printed media. The Saudi government was involved in a range of reintegration efforts, encouraged defection from al-Qaeda fighters. So I think from a U.S. standpoint, in addition to what we often focus on, that is the security and intelligence aspects, I do think there is an element that we have got to work with countries in the region and local actors to better combat the message that comes from al-Qaeda, its affiliates, and its allied groups. That's something I think the United States does not do particularly well. And even where it has done it well, it's generally been clandestine, covert, so you wouldn't even see it anyway.
Dan, you emphasize that in order to quell the expansion of al-Qaeda, that we have to highlight the differences between al-Qaeda and its self-interest and the convictions and self-interest of local groups, in particular, how they diverge about nationalism and democracy. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Al-Qaeda pushes the idea that all Muslims are one, that really their true identity should be religious rather than, say, Egyptian or Iraqi. But most people in the world, and I would say most people in the Muslim world, have very strong national identities as well. And the Al-Qaeda brand pushes against this, and the United States should, when possible, try to emphasize that these are foreigners. These are often foreigners coming into countries like Somalia or Yemen, where there's a fairly strong sense of local pride and a certain sense of xenophobia. On democracy, there is incredibly strong support for democracy in the Muslim world and in the Arab world. These are very powerful ideas there, and these are people who know what tyranny looks like firsthand, so it's not surprising. Al-Qaeda, though, sees democracy as anathema. This is something that places man's law above God's and, as a result, is to be fought against. And what we see are critics within the religious community, critics of Al-Qaeda, embracing democracy. They see it as a chance to expand the role of religion in society. And we should highlight this difference, that what Al-Qaeda champions is fundamentally unpopular and goes against not only the wishes of the majority of Muslims, but even the wishes of the majority of people in the narrow Salafist community from which they draw.
Dan, I think that one reason that Al-Qaeda has dropped off the radar screen for many Americans is that there has not been a horrific attack like 9/11. What is your perception of the threat of something like that happening now that we are beginning to wind down the war in Afghanistan and we've withdrawn from Iraq?
Certainly everyone who thinks about terrorism is nervous about declaring victory and saying there's no threat. If you look at the last 10 years, we've seen several very close calls, most recently in 2009, where an al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula bomber was able to get an explosive aboard an airplane and almost detonate it. So chance has been an important factor here, too. That said, there's no question that al-Qaeda is weaker than it was on 9/11. Its global network has been hit hard. Its safe havens are under attack. So to do a large-scale, spectacular operation that requires years of planning, it's not impossible for the group, but I would say much, much harder. However, I would say they are able to do smaller-scale attacks, attacks on transportation, things that do not involve significant preparation or overcoming significant defenses. This makes the group less dangerous, but it doesn't mean that the threat is over completely.
Daniel Bimon, professor in the Security Studies Program of Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and director of research at the Sabin Center for the Middle East Policy for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Wade.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. Yemen is home to the al-Qaeda-linked group Ansar al-Sharia. Here's General Yahya Saleh, nephew of the former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, and now the head of the country's Central Security Force. He spoke to PBS for the Frontline episode Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which aired this past May.
Al-Qaeda today is not the same as al-Qaeda a year and a half ago. They have more followers, more money, more guns. The area they control is bigger. And this is a great danger.
We're discussing al-Qaeda's global expansion. You can join the conversation. Are countries in political transition sitting ducks for al-Qaeda? What role should the U.S. play in stopping al-Qaeda? We're talking with Seth Jones, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and former senior advisor at U.S. Special Operations Command. He's the author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of al-Qaeda After 9/11. Seth, I wanted to ask you if you concurred with Dan's conclusions about the kind of threat al-Qaeda proposes now to the United States.
Well, I would generally conclude with Dan that in most of the areas al-Qaeda is operating, it appears to be focused on targeting and killing locals. In fact, according to data I've put together, about 95% of those individuals that have been killed by al-Qaeda attacks have been locals, as opposed to attacks in, say, London or Washington or Madrid in 2004. Where I would disagree with Dan a little bit, though, is it does appear that over the past 10 years, al-Qaeda in some ways has become more powerful in at least a few areas. One is its number of affiliates has increased. Second, if you take a look, and this goes back to your segment from a minute ago, in places like Yemen, in 2008, al-Qaeda had no serious sanctuary in that country. Now it has a decent-sized foothold along the Gulf of Aden in Shabwa Governorate, in Abyan, even around the capital, Sana'a. So in some areas, al-Qaeda has strengthened. It's increased its number of attacks. We've seen that in Iraq today, where it's up at now about 30 attacks per month as opposed to around 20 or so for the last 2 years. And then it's also worth noting that last week in testimony on Capitol Hill, Matthew Olson, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, did indicate concerns from al-Qaeda in Iraq that it was increasing its plotting toward the U.S. homeland. So we certainly don't see a lot of near misses, at least in the last year or two, but we are seeing the growth of the broader movement. At the moment, it does appear to be focusing on killing and targeting locals as opposed to the U.S.
Seth, let's take some callers. Hal is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hal, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
The reason I was calling, I was very fortunate to travel to Mali in November of 2007, and I have been up in Timbuktu before. And one of the things that I understand has been going on through perusing online media has been the defacing of various mosques, because in Mali, when Islam established, they were very tolerant of allowing the native population to incorporate things like animist elements into the architecture. It's a shame to see the type of repression and to hear the reports of people being stoned to death in this country. I personally believe that we really need to do whatever we can to stand up to this threat to individual freedom, because without individual freedom, democracies can't exist.
Seth, Hal is mourning the destruction of a open welcoming of other traditions culture there.
Well, I express the same concern. And it, frankly, it's not that different from what we saw in the 1990s in Afghanistan, where with certainly al-Qaeda's encouragement, the Taliban decimated the statues, the Buddhist statues in Bamiyan, in central parts of the country. And we have seen elements of al-Qaeda and some of its allies do this kind of defacing of other cultures, which they thumb their noses at. On the caller's comments about what to do, I would note, I think we've learned some lessons on what not to do. Sending, in my view, large numbers of American conventional forces, as the U.S. did in Iraq beginning in 2003, and even as the U.S. did in Afghanistan, not the right solution. It tends to radicalize locals. But acting both on the civilian side and on the sort of more clandestine side, I think there have been effective opportunities to work with locals. And I think that's really the way to do this in countries like Mali.
So occupation is in our rearview mirror, and you applaud.
I hope it's in our rearview mirror. It would be interesting if the U.S. were attacked at some point in a major American city, whether there would be some individuals calling for some form of occupation overseas from where that attack generated. But I hope that it's in our rearview mirrors, and if that's the case, then I certainly applaud.
Tom is calling from Evansville, Indiana. Tom, hello.
Hello, Wade. My company has offices in Nigeria. I've been there multiple times over the last 10 years. And one thing that 10 years ago, we could go into Joe, we could go into the northern states with absolutely no fear. However, over the last 2 years, the and I don't think it's Al-Qaeda. It's Muslims. I mean, these guys aren't attacking with weapons and grenades. They're attacking with sticks and spears and small guns, burning churches, driving out Christians. This is strictly, and I think what bothers me, Dan talked about the Muslim or the Al-Qaeda being killing locals. Well, they're not locals in Nigeria. There's one thing that unites them. They're Christians. And our press just doesn't say that. They are trying to purge all non-Muslims out of the four northern states. There's no question about that. And I think if, and they've just about done it. They've killed over 1,200 Christians so far. And when you go there, if you're in Abuja, the security, so far the government has gone to separate the two and to protect, if you will, the foreigners and the people in the Christian South with a moderate degree of effect. But they haven't done anything to persecute the perpetrators of the crimes in the North.
Seth, Tom is talking about religious intolerance and cleansing.
Well, I think Tom is exactly right. That is what is going on in Nigeria, including parts of northern Nigeria. I would note that the probably the most dangerous and certainly most active group operating in northern Nigeria is, or at least one of them, is Boko Haram. Boko Haram is a Salafist group. We know from the Bin Laden archives that were captured in the Abbottabad raids by Navy SEALs that Bin Laden had been in contact with Boko Haram as far back as 2009. We know elements of Boko Haram have trained in countries like Nigeria and bomb making. So they have actually been involved in some very high-profile improvised explosive devices, car bombs, and those attack patterns and the trending is growing, and they're doing more of it. And one of their primary targets is indeed, as Tom points out, Christians operating in Nigeria.
Rick is calling from Tom Brooks, Virginia. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
My question is this. One of the previous experts had said that Al-Qaeda is able to get a footprint in where there are weak governments. Where there are strong governments, they've been able to stamp them out. The corollary is that weak governments tend to be poor governments. And so you have poor governments from Indonesia all the way to Nigeria where they're able to set up shop. The question for me is, they're always going to be able to do this. You can't make these places rich. So what is the United States doing chasing these people all over the world at our cost, our expense, and our trouble? Why not the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris and the people that have the money? Shouldn't they be doing more? Because this is really a problem in their backyard and should be paramount to their personal interests.
Seth, I don't think the word poverty has passed our lips yet, but it is now.
Sure. Poverty is definitely an issue for states that are dealing with threats by Al-Qaeda or other extremist groups. And I think Rick is right to point out that in a range of these countries, the U.S. needs to find other countries and local actors that it can it can encourage to do this. I mean, one great area right now. I mean, he mentioned the Philippines and Indonesia. One great example now is Syria, and Syria is a place where there are strong interests in encouraging the Jordanians, the Turks, and the Saudis to get involved in targeting the very extremist Sunni elements operating in Syria. So by no means should this be only a U.S.-led effort. In a range of places, actually, there are actors that are probably better placed, better understand the local culture to do this. But I would just say, in general, U.S. has got to look out for its own national security interest. If we have active plotting against the U.S. homeland from a given area, do we want to outsource that to somebody else? If it's local, then and the targets are local, then maybe we can take that risk.
Ron is calling from Rensselaer Falls, New York. Ron, hello.
Hi, Wade.
Hi.
Yeah, my concern is that thinking that we as the U.S. in participating with these other nations to fight Al-Qaeda, it's just a short-term political solution. We used Iraq and Iran to play against each other. Saddam Hussein, and then he became our enemy. we're in Pakistan, and Pakistan government is corrupt to the core with bribes and billions of dollars we send them. And what happens is the very so-called strong governments that are fighting Al-Qaeda are the ones being hated by their own people because they're, you know, they got all the U.S. money. We kill them. We kill people with collateral damage with our Predator drones. And, you know, every time we kill these terrorists, it's always suspected terrorists. There's never any verification that it is. So we cause a tremendous amount of resentment that, oh, yeah, the U.S. is helping us kill Al-Qaeda, but we happen to be supporting governments that the people themselves, if they don't like Al-Qaeda, they at least nationalistically feel sympathy. Let's get these Americans out who support these governments that oppress us in the name. And these governments know all they are just human shield walls for our protection, not theirs.
There is a foreign policy fallout from fighting this fight.
Oh, I think there's no question that's true. I mean, there is definitely a foreign how you do this is a big issue. You put large numbers of boots on the ground, I think, as we've seen, especially U.S. conventional boots on the ground. It tends to have a, in some cases, counterproductive impact. As Ron pointed out, providing large amounts of support to the government in Pakistan, which in many cases has been viewed as illegitimate, is not always helpful. The drone strikes have definitely been viewed by Pakistanis as and raised anti-Americanism in Pakistan. So how you do it is very important. Again, I would go back to Dan Byman's comment earlier about Saudi Arabia. Interesting case. U.S. involvement was very much in the background, did not trigger large amounts of anti-Americanism. Al-Qaeda was crushed.
Michael is calling from South Burlington, Vermont. Michael, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I want to respond to what was said before about strong governments tend to keep Al-Qaeda out, weak governments bring them in. What bothers me and what wasn't mentioned is that you have all of these strong governments are basically repressive regimes. You have monarchies even in modern countries like Jordan. And it was also said earlier that, you know, the people want democracy. Well, from what I can tell, I don't think that even the strong governments would allow democracy to occur. See what's happening what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in the other countries that were part of the Arab Spring revolt. So I'm not so confident that a strong government would allow democracy to happen. I think that what we're doing, and I've been doing for many years, is supporting strong governments that are repressive because of the oil.
Seth, do we have to choose between anti-democratic dictatorships and Al-Qaeda? I hate that choice.
Well, here's the problem is, and there's been actually a fair amount of research on this, there does not appear to be a correlation, certainly not a strong correlation, between terrorism and democracy. And what that means is democratic states are no better or no worse in stamping out terrorism than repressive regimes. In fact, in some cases, repressive regimes have had some advantages. In democracies, we've seen Spain deal with its Basque problem. In Great Britain, we've seen the IRA problem. And so what we've seen actually in parts of the Arab Spring is democracy has weakened a range of governments, Libya, Egypt, Yemen right now, and it's provided an avenue for Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups to try and gain a foothold. Democracy is a good thing, and it should be encouraged. It should also be pointed out that democracy does not in and of itself mean that terrorism over the long run will be stamped out. So the challenge is we don't see a strong correlation between the two, and I do think, as Michael noted, that we've got to be really careful that what we're not doing in all cases is sacrificing our political interests, human rights, for example, democracy, for short-term security ones.
Seth, if boots on the ground and occupation is not the way to go here, how are we going to fight this, for the coming decade?
Well, I think the most important question is when you look back over the past several decades, how have terrorist groups generally ended? And they generally end not with a large-scale military footprint, but they have several things. And I think this does suggest a way forward for the U.S. One is security and intelligence services. Second is information operations. And third, we have got to figure out ways to better deal with the root causes of what's causing terrorism in these countries.
Seth Jones, senior political scientist and associate director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Seth, it's been great having you on the show today. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Wade.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.